My name is Ruth Steenerson. The title of the session in dealing with our contraries, reconciling the contraries, is good and evil. And I'm going to draw some material, illustrative material, from J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, and hope that we can get something worthwhile said out of that. I'm going to say a good many statements that I'm going to make a good many statements that I know that many of you could argue back with very successfully, and you may well feel like doing that, because I'm getting into statements that are so abstract and so broad that if you come at them from a slightly different angle, you will know there are other things that could be said. But sometimes I think that's worthwhile too, even if each statement may need to be refined further before we take it as valid for our whole lives. Good and evil seem like some very obvious words to be talking about. Everyone knows what good and evil mean, don't they? Even though they may not know how to reconcile them in their own lives, surely we all know what good and evil means. Except that's a statement that I wouldn't agree with. I think we all agree in part. We've been taught about such things as conscience and those ways of training our sense of right and wrong, but we've probably also been taught that our conscience isn't always entirely dependable either, unless it has been shaped and trained in the right way. One of the things that I kept thinking about as I was thinking of this presentation, I think that goodness, this is a concept that has had a very bad press. Not only in our own day, but for a long time. Oftentimes it's portrayed in one of two negative ways, I think. It's portrayed as dull, colorless, uninteresting. Even when we talk to children sometimes and we say, be good, what we're really saying is, be dull, don't disturb anybody, don't rock the boat, don't do anything that calls too much attention to yourself. Some of our great writers have worked hard at trying to portray a truly good person. And it's amazing how much trouble they've had with the portrayals which they attempt. Charles Dickens, for instance, tried in several of his works to portray a truly good person. And when he finally most satisfied himself, the character that he had created was a blacksmith, Joe Gargery, in Great Expectations, probably not terribly bright, and yet at the same time a very generous, warm, truly good man. Dostoevsky wrestled with the problem of creating a truly good person. And he came up with two, both of which seem to have had some problems for him and some satisfactions for him. One of them was in his novel, The Idiot. The central character, Mishkin, is one of Dostoevsky's portrayals of a truly good person. But he's a person that nobody else can really understand. He's a person that really doesn't get through with what he means to a good many other people. And we probably might have a little trouble with really interpreting him in that role. And then in Crime and Punishment, Sonia, the saintly prostitute, is another of the characters that probably to more of us comes through as a truly good person. So there can be a danger that goodness comes across in its press as being dull and uninteresting, somehow hard to understand, hard to accept, as really exciting or something that is worth working toward in our own lives or in our society. I think another negative image which oftentimes goodness has is that it's something that's rather pretentious, rather stuffy. And if somebody said of us, probably my so-and-so is really a good person, we ourselves might be left sort of scratching our heads if that's what it means. If somehow or other our goodness has come across well or not so well. Well, evil is another word, I think, that has had some press problems, but not in the same direction necessarily. It's certainly been, I think, a problem word in our day. There has been a good deal of attempt, I suspect you would agree with me, and if you don't, by all means say so, to assume that evil is something that can safely be denied in many contexts, as any rate. That there has been in our own day a good deal of denial of the existence of evil. And there has been an association of evil with what is only relative, what we maybe don't have to take as terribly seriously, always somewhat undefinable because we always have to be sure that we look at it in a particular situation and draw our conclusions concerning it only in that one situation. And, you know, evil was something that ordinary people used to think they could identify by sight, you know, or on sight. Everybody knew, didn't they, when a thing was evil or whether it was good. When I think back to the little Scandinavian-American town in North Dakota where I grew up years ago, it seems to me I remember that people were much more confident about their ability to identify good and evil. Everybody knew movies were evil. There was no question about that. And there was no doubt either that a pure woman did not wear lipstick. You know, these decisions were, I don't know how, whether we soaked them in with our mother's milk or what, but we all knew a great deal about many of those things, and we identified them as good and evil very easily. Now, that, of course, does not necessarily lead us to truth. If you're aware of Arthur Miller's drama, The Crucible, you may remember that this town, which thinks that it is able to identify witchcraft and evil very easily, has to come to understand at the end that what they have really identified is not witchcraft, but some mischievous girls causing a lot of havoc in the community. They had looked at something and said it was evil, but it needed to have a more careful delineation. So when we get into this whole business of identifying good and evil, we're into a very touchy subject on which there can be a good deal of disagreement. There certainly have been many in our own century, though, I think, who have tried to laugh off the whole idea of the reality of evil, as evil being something that's out of date, something that certainly they may have needed to worry about in the past, but we don't any longer. We're liberated. We can be properly sure that we understand these things. It's something that we have seen through, seen above, and we're liberated now from the need to be concerned about it. Now, I can't understand for the life of me how a century that has seen a succession of holocausts is able to look at this whole idea of good and evil and say that evil is not a problem that liberated human beings need to be concerned about. When you look at the Holocaust, not only in Germany, but in Cambodia, in El Salvador, in South Africa, and in many other things from our century, it seems to me that evil is obviously with us and obviously something yet to be a concern. When one of the most enlightened, or country that claims to be one of the most enlightened countries in the world finds that the way to enforce its power and to hold up its economies is to stimulate low conflict wars in the rest of the world, I think we need to realize evil is still on the scene. And where there are many who deliberately ruin the health and the lives of others in order to make money by it, it seems to me we've still got evil on the stage. Now, does somebody want to take that on? Some statements that you'd like to disagree with, contradict, reinforce?
Any
anything you want to say yet? You've got to use your opportunities, because otherwise I keep talking. You might not get a chance later on. I hope you will, though. Most of us, I suspect, even in the church, at any rate in our day, are more hesitant to talk about evil, more apologetic about identifying evil, more ready to identify our hesitation about evil with the fact that supposedly we are more compassionate, we're more sensitive these days, we're less judgmental about other people, would it were true. We're somehow embarrassed at the whole idea of evil. The term may still be around in theology and in literature and in philosophy, but it's heard far less often, would you agree, in the behavioral sciences. There's a good deal more talk there about causal things that bring forth certain kinds of behavior, and this is good. You know, we need to see through these things. But at the same time, I think the discussion of good and evil has moved more in the traditional humanities areas and probably less in the behavioral sciences than in the others. Anybody agree with that? Disagree with that? Somebody should be willing to take me on that one. Oh, okay. You don't. I wonder, when I think about some of these things, when we think of some of the things that bother us in our society, some of the things that we really believe to be unhealthy and detrimental to our society, what would happen if all the church people in America spoke out on some of those issues?
Change.
There'd be change. But you know, it's even within the church, many of us are not going to put ourselves out on a limb. We want to be thought to be very tolerant. We want to stay off the hook. And so many of the things that even bother us rather deeply in our own thinking are left unquestioned. I think we need to ask some real questions about how our media are shaping our responses to good and evil.
Amen.
I think I would identify particularly television there, but certainly not only television. It seems interesting to notice how producers seem to assume that if you want to get to the largest audience possible, that evil is much more of a drawing card than good. How much money do you suppose many producers would put into an advertisement for a television show that was designed to show goodness in its most ultimate form? And compare that with the kind of an audience that you would get, especially in a nighttime movie that dealt with horror and violence. I don't think there'd be much question about where the audience would tend to materialize. I've often wondered why these stories of horror and violence so dominate our nighttime television. Now, I know the easy answer for that is that the children have gone to bed by then. Some of them have. But this isn't an issue we really have much time to dig into. Does anyone have anything to say on that? Yes?
Well, Mr. Mankin proposed that no one ever went broke underestimating the taste of the American public.
And it sounds to me like you thought that was good enough to remember.
I think he may be correct.
Mm-hmm. There are those who will give us an argument on the other side by saying that no movie that is ever made has ever brought the income that The Sound of Music has. And maybe that means we have to kind of look at the other side too, but I'm still, I think, along with you and Mankin on that, sir.
Ian Forrester suggests that it's not evil that is the question, but characters that either go toward goodness or away from it.
So it's the tension.
So it's the change in the character that takes place that arouses interest, rather than whether he is a good evil person to start with or an evil person to start with.
Interesting.
That you don't like static characters. They have to have movement.
Right. And part of what Dickens and Dostoevsky often seem to be saying is that it's harder to make convincing the movement toward good than it is the movement toward evil. Maybe that isn't even something that would always hold true. Well, that was sort of introductory, anyway, to getting into the subject of good and evil. I'd like to turn to Lord of the Rings now and talk about that for a little bit. At the time when the book first came out, I was quite unaware of the thing for quite a while. And the way I found it was that my students started absolutely nagging at me to read Lord of the Rings. Have you read it yet? Have you read Lord of the Rings yet? No, I haven't. Well, you got to read that. And finally, in a kind of self-defense, I decided, yes, indeed, I better read Lord of the Rings so I know at least how to talk with them about it. I discovered, you probably may laugh at this, but maybe some of you had the same experience, I discovered that I read that book mostly in the daytime because that story created in me such a sense of the reality and the omnipresence of evil that it didn't make very good nighttime reading for me at all. I had more trouble going to sleep after I had been reading that book. Now, pretty soon I was thinking more about the answer to the question of why were, especially young people, but other people too, both in England and in the United States and in other countries where the book was being rapidly translated, why were these people, by the millions, reading this long fantasy? And so I began to talk with my students about it. I listened and I tried to corral some of the answers. And there were certainly many reasons possible. For one thing, Tolkien is a good storyteller. And once you get involved in the conflict of that particular story, it's not hard to wonder how it is going to turn out. But one that I came to hear quite often and that I found very interesting was the idea that the young people, especially of that era immediately after World War II, were consciously or unconsciously rejecting much of what they were being told about evil not really being anything to be concerned about. That they were being told oftentimes in public institutions of learning, but also sometimes in church institutions, that after all, we're too sophisticated now to really have much concern about that. And these young people living in a world where they had been being taught the history of the past two decades were saying we don't believe it. And they were finding in Tolkien, I think, a concern with some of the issues that they thought were important for the world that they were living in. They were worried in many ways about their own world. And in Tolkien's fantasy, they could take up many of these issues that they were concerned about in a form that was somewhat removed from them. Fantasy does that. It can move a concern away where you can look at it a little bit more objectively, although fantasy may seem to be the ultimate in subjectivity. You can look at it from a distance and a perspective and find what you think it means. In Lord of the Rings, they were not being preached at about good and evil. They were being told a story by an expert storyteller who held their interest, scared them half out of their wits, but at the same time presented good as a reality as it came to them through a good and wise a wizard, a good man who someday would return to be king, and a simple hobbit who in goodwill would try to do what he could in order to bring to a good conclusion the fight against evil. They saw in the story of the hope of Tolkien evil not as something tantalizing and something that one wanted to play with a little bit to see how serious it really was, but they saw it as twisted, as horrible, as ugly, and as destructive. And they read it, and then they went off to plague their English teachers about why they hadn't read. Now, I'd like to summarize just briefly, and it will be briefly and inadequately, the story of Lord of the Rings for those of you who haven't read it, and I'm sure there are some of you who probably haven't. The conflict in the novel is essentially a power struggle between good and evil. There are a number of kinds of characters. There are hobbits, look sort of like rabbits, and have some fur growing on their toes, but they're fairly intelligent. They're good-natured, and they're quite numerous in certain areas that are called the Shire. They don't get involved in much other than eating, socializing, and being merry. Then there are human beings. Tolkien would not win much favor with feminists, as I'm sure many of you might already have thought about. His characters are almost entirely male. The elves do have some beautiful women, and the elves are always these spiritual, angelic, beautiful beings, and always on the side of good. But women really don't get much attention in The Lord of the Rings, so one sort of has to decide if one wants to enjoy the story that we'll deal with that issue somewhere else. There are wizards who vary between good, such as Gandalf, and evil, and they can be swung from one side to the other. They're one of the movable groups as evil and good make their appeal for their loyalty. There are dwarves. They live underground. They're marvelous technicians and builders. They are loyal, very loyal to those who befriend them, but again, they're one of the groups that can be swung. And then there are the orcs. Now, anytime you name somebody something, an orc, you're doing something to it. I know the naming can be significant in itself, and the orcs are always on the side of evil. So you have these various groups of people, and you have then the elves always on the side of good, the orcs always on the side of the evil, and the others swayable according to the appeals that are made to them. Now, all of this story happens in a place that Tolkien calls Middle Earth, which looks suspiciously like the Midlands of England, that area somewhere between Cambridge and Oxford. But Middle Earth, after all, is fantasy, so we don't have to try to pin it down everywhere. But the control of Middle Earth is vested in One, capital O-N-E. And this One has the ultimate control over what happens in Middle Earth. There have been made in the past 21 power-bearing rings. And a certain number of these rings have been given to each of these groups. Three of them have gone to the elf kings, and those are safe because the elves are good. Seven have been given to the dwarves. Nine have been given to men, and there is one for the character that is called the Dark Lord. And this one ring is extremely dangerous because it is the one that controls all the others. And so the one that has control of the one ring has power. We're never really given much discussion about how his power would compare with the one. It's somewhat inferior, but he has power enough to do a great deal of mischief. Now, this ring has been lost, with all the tragedy that could mean for all of these characters that live on Earth. It's been lost in the depths of the Earth. It's found by a repulsive little creature called Gollum, who talks about it as his precious, who loses it to one of the hobbits, Bilbo, in a kind of a riddle playing that they do. And so at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, Bilbo has this ring. And he is, like most of the hobbits, a fairly good-natured one. He manages to live with the ring for a while. But it's a dangerous ring even to hold because it saps the strength of the holder. And it threatens to possess the wearer in order to, and drain his energy. After all that, the sources of evil are always looking for this ring to get it into their hands. Now the time comes as the forces of evil intensify their grasp for power, when the forces for good are aware that this is happening, they're also aware that they're going to be on the losing side if they can't find the one ring. And the only way to undo its power is to take it back where it was made, to the Mount of Doom, and to get it into the fire, the volcanic fire at the center of the Mount of Doom. If they can do that, then the power of that ring will be destroyed. But it's an extremely dangerous venture to try to get it back through the lands that are governed by the Dark Lord and get the ring unmade in the fire. And there is nobody who really wants to take that on until Frodo, one of the hobbits. And remember, these hobbits aren't the big people of the world. There's kind of the little people of the Shires. Frodo is asked if he would consider doing it. And he says yes, and then he wishes a long time afterward that he never would have said that. But he said it, and being the faithful little hobbit that he is, he will try. And so with the companionship of his servant Sam, certainly one of the most lovable little characters in fantasy of our century, I think, Sam goes with Frodo, and they head through the land of the Dark Lord to try to get to the fire in which the ring can be unmade. Off in the countries around, the areas around, the forces of good are joining in military struggle with the forces of evil, but with the sure awareness that unless the ring is unmade, the evil will win. It's a quest story. A story in which someone is going on a journey who, if he can complete his mission, will be a hero. But if he cannot complete his mission, will leave the world in a worse shape, certainly than he finds it. That's just a very brief resume of what happens. And of course, since some of you may not have read it, I'm not going to tell you how it turns out. But there are some more things about it that I would like us to deal with, and I have a handout here. I wonder, would a couple of you be willing to distribute these while I keep talking? How about it? I was going to start some over there, too. I think there'll be enough here. We're not going to have time to talk about everything that is on these sheets, but there are some things that might help us to go over some of this material a little bit more rapidly. I'm just going to keep talking as these come along. The first thing that I have done at the beginning is simply to pose a couple questions that we might have in the back of our minds as we think about the rest of these sheets. The definition of good and evil in our day is not going to go into detail on that more than I did in the introduction. It is something I think that still, about which there is still something to be said. The second question asks, how do we in our own experience in day-to-day living make distinctions between good and evil? And that could be an interesting study, because most of us, I suspect, make them almost subconsciously on the basis of what we have been told as small children. But we won't stop for that now. The next part of the handout, and thank you very much to those of you who did the distributing, the second part deals with some Bible references, first to good and goodness, and then to evil. Good is spoken of as identifiable, as a reality, something certainly that has to be encountered by a human being. God says, I will do thee good. As though good is something very concrete in that setting, I will give thee the good of the land may have a different meaning, but you notice the word is clearly seen as identifiable. Good is an attribute of God. It reproduces itself. A good tree brings forth good fruit. It exists in the form of acts, speech, intentions, vision, news, thoughts, works, and a good many other places that we might identify. It's associated with peace in Scripture. It is associated with mercy, with loyalty, with faithfulness, with a merry heart, with understanding. There is good teaching. Uprightness is a kind of a synonym for it. Associated with fairness, justice, maturity, law, creation. God's creation is good. He looks upon it as that. Saints are associated with goodness. And it is a fruit of the Spirit. These are only a few out of many, many things that we might say about goodness, taking our cues from Bible references. Now when we look at evil in the same way, we certainly recognize from Scripture that evil is a serious complication of life, and it is oftentimes in Scripture identified by that word sin. The good that I would, I do not. Paul says, the evil that I would not, that I do. A wretched man that I am. The ability to have life complicated by evil. Thing we don't need to be told is reality. It's associated with rebellion, with pride, with hatred, with what comes naturally to the human heart, with ungodliness, deviousness, the love of money, the tongue. The book of Proverbs is full of references to the association of speech with evil. It's defined in terms of what rulers do, as a force that influences and motivates. It's identified as a matter of choice, not something that just happens to us, an active force rather, a cause for punishment. Specific people are identified as evil. It is to be hated, to be overcome with good, to be turned away from, to be put away, to be abstained from. And it is never to be played with. It is not something that is safe. That word safe sometimes gets an interesting use in religious language. You may remember, if you know the Chronicles of Narnia, that one of the characters is asked about Aslan, the great golden lion. Is he safe? And the answer is no, he is not safe. He is good. And the implication is that that there can be a difference there. Good and evil are often paired. The terms constantly used together. And there are references there that would illustrate that. Now, moving on to the oral resume of the Lord of the Kings, I've done about as much of that, I think, as is necessary to do. But about halfway through that paragraph, there's a statement that I think I didn't mention. It is evident in the creation of this world of Middle Earth that evil must always be resisted or it will take over. And it will never, as far as anyone knows, be possible to sit back and think that it has been conquered for good. Now, I think we recognize the truth of that in human existence. I suppose we would question that in terms of the Christian message, where we have the hope of a time coming when evil has been thoroughly and for good conquered, and so it no longer needs to be the center or a central idea of existence. But in this world terminology, you notice it's not hard to recognize the idea that there's a constant need for the struggle against it. It may appear in one form in one generation. It may appear in a different form in another generation, but by and large, what we can identify as evil is always something that will demand attention. Now, skipping that, the rest of that section, what I have done is to choose some theme statements from Lord of the Rings and suggest that we look at them together and see if we have something to say in agreement or in challenge as far as these statements are concerned. Some of them are rather obvious. I think some of them are probably more debatable ones. But let's try some of them out. First, are choices between good and evil a result of choice or fate? Well, if we want to stay on that for the rest of the night, I suppose we could, couldn't we? Hardy certainly stayed on it for most of his writing career. Tess of the D'Urbervilles and several of his novels are a continual hassle with this question of, does what happened to human beings happen because of fate, or does it happen because of choices that they have made? Well, Tolkien has a statement relating to that that says, this is Gandalf, the good wizard, incidentally, now we have chosen and the tides of fate are flowing. Now we have chosen and now the tides of fate are flowing. What does that sound like to you? Which shall we blame for what happens? Choice or fate?
Choice,
doesn't it? Because the fates begin to roll, the tides of fate begin to flow only after choice has been made. Some of us would agree with that and some of us wouldn't, probably. But the whole idea of moral responsibility for choice of behavior and attitude is certainly present in Tolkien. Number two mentions that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis share a kind of a common definition of morality as an imperfect sense of decency and right behavior recognized by all free people. If you have read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, you may remember that one of the things that Lewis brings out is that his own, if we say conversion to Christianity, or at least his own acceptance after a period of disagreement with it, his own acceptance of Christianity is very much on the basis of the fact that he sees in human beings a moral nature, and he can't for the life of him figure out where it came from if it doesn't come from the existence of some greater being. And so you have this idea that he shares with Tolkien there, and which permeates Lord of the Rings in the sense that you can expect these beings to know what is right and wrong. You don't have to define it for them every time. They choose it and act according to their understanding of it. Well, that's not a major place to stop either. Third one, there is unavoidable human engagement in the struggle to defend good and conquer evil. You simply can't say, I just don't want to be involved. And the quotation comes from a scholar of Tolkien who says, he's quoting again from Tolkien himself, it is not required of a person that he always love his burden, and the burden is moral responsibility there, or be patient under it, only that he continue to bear it. Again, emphasizing this idea of you can't evade involvement in this kind of struggle. As a human being, you are a part of it. Anyone have something they want to say yet? Yes.
That ties directly back into the statement number one, once that choice is made, the tides of fate, or shall we say the consequences mm-hmm. of the choice, flow forth unavoidably. Yeah. And if you put yourself there, well, you're going to carry it one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
You're simply going to take it.
Thank you. Good. Anyone else have?
Yeah, I was thinking that sometimes, though, we can get some kind of feel guilty about not doing enough good, or not mm-hmm. being enough, you know, enough or whatever. And I would relate that to a reading from the Bible of a couple of weeks ago. I don't remember exactly. That talks about the Samaritan stopping and helping somebody, you know, was dying, mm-hmm. and just do whatever he could, and then leave and just go on with his life. And if you want to interpret traditionally, we would think that, you know, not tradition, if you could look at it and say, well, you know, he didn't really care about that person. But I interpreted at that time, when I read the story, that we can do a little, mm-hmm. and just, it's again, you know, just make a choice, do whatever we can, and then go on mm-hmm. with things.
Okay, I think there are a couple of things that I was thinking as you said that. I think when you started out, there are, evil can be omission as well as commission. And when it comes to the Good Samaritan, because he doesn't stop until he has taken the man where he can be cared for and promises that he will come back and pay again, so he does what he can and then he goes on. You know, there's a real temptation, I think, in our day to say that because we can't do everything, we can't do anything.
Right, that's what I meant.
I so often think of this when I think of the environmental movement. We talk about many of the things that need to be done. Well, what can we do that is going to really make much difference? At least we can do the thing that we can do individually. And it may not shake the world, but at least the world is going to be a little bit less in a precarious position. Thank you. Anyone else have something to? Okay, well, let's look at the next one, which is maybe a rather more difficult one. Does the identification of good and evil change with the time? And a quote from the book says, good and evil have not changed since yesteryear, nor are they one thing among elves and dwarves and another among men. It is a man's part, you notice all these sexist terms, is a man's part to discern them. How about this business that the identification of good and evil are timeless?
Our perception of good and evil changes.
Our perception may change, but the actual reality remains the same. Am I hearing right? Yes.
We complain about the good old times, and they're not here anymore. And is that because we don't think that the people now discern between them as well as we think we discern?
I wonder. It could well be, couldn't it, it's a little glowing praise of how well we used to discern what those things were. All right, yes?
Is this really a question of labeling? When the Wehrmacht and the SS moved across Europe and Russia, their belt buckles had the insignia of Nazism and Gott mit uns, God with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, you know, this was kind of an imagery of how they felt about their mission in life.
Mm-hmm.
They put a label on good, perhaps, that the rest of the world would consider to be very evil.
Yet no matter what insignia they wore, good and evil had not changed. Only their vision of where their particular part fit into it.
Yeah.
Is that, what would a theologian, can I put you on the spot, Rob? What would a theologian say about this question of, does the identification of good and evil change with the times?
I think that Christian theology has always held, when considering good and evil as theological abstractions, that they constitute an eternal reality,
mm-hmm.
Or at least an ongoing reality. Christian theology is inherently dualistic, so that you have good versus evil. Perception of it varies, as well, I should think, as the manifestations of it, so that within any given moment of history, within any given community of history, one might find evil dominating good, and the manifestations of evil dominating. But in terms of what constitutes evil and what constitutes good, I suspect, as theological abstractions, those would be consistent throughout all of time.
We've become very afraid in our day of the word absolute, and so we're very slow to identify anything as absolute, and yet I find your statement there, and they're helpful. Let's look at number five. The idea of goodness promoting goodness. Frodo, the little hobbit, has mercy on the repulsive Gollum. And you would wonder why, and yet it is partly because he is merciful that the outcome of the quest is what it is. And then accompanying with that, the idea of evil creating more evil, power as a corrupting thing in proportion to its being absolute. Both ideas, and that goodness produces more goodness, that evil produces more evil. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Go along with that?
I'm going to disagree.
Okay.
I think evil has a tendency to burn itself out.
Evil has a tendency to wear itself out.
Or to burn itself out.
Burn itself out.
You know, example, the German example, someone just talked
Nazism
about.
Nazism eventually.
Nazism burned itself out. I mean, the evil there became so dominant that it could not function.
Well, it wasn't just that it burned itself out, although it did internally. The concentration camp, the slave economy, all of that doomed them ultimately to fail. They tied up so many divisions. They wasted their resources on an inherently evil act. But it also provoked a reaction from the rest of the world, and there was a war. So it seems that the evil can promote evil, but it also provokes reaction.
Nice. Well, not for nothing, you still have a war, I mean, between East and West, because they are afraid of the potentiality of evil that can happen again, mm-hmm. in fact. And so they may make a rational choice. I mean, that's what happened. That you might disagree with or not, but...
Okay, we are not going to stay with any of these until we have them firmly settled. But it's at least we throw out some things to think about here. I think we're going to skip number 6 in part because it's long, and the second place because we've got the backside of the sheet and our time is gone. Number 7 suggests that evil is never defeated once for all. And the quotation is always after a defeat and a respite. The shadow takes another shape and grows again. And those of you who know the White Witch in Lewis's Narnia may remember there is the same kind of awareness that you can vanquish the White Witch for now, but she'll be back in some other form again. Is Tolkien off the track here, or do you find it possible to go along with him in this idea that evil may take a rest, but it will be back? I see nodding heads that seem to find it possible to go along with that one. Number 8, I think, is one that is sometimes hard to admit the truth of, but I don't find it hard to accept that one. Evil is not defeated without cost to those who oppose it. Frodo at the end says, "I have been deeply hurt, Sam. I tried to save the Shire and it has been saved, but not for me." It must often be so, Sam, when things are in danger, someone has to give them up, lose them, so that others may keep them. And again, some of you are giving indications with your facial expressions that you find this something you can go along with. I find myself doing it, and I suspect there may be some of you who have too, but it's so easy to say, "Well, I would like to fight against that particular thing, but you know, it costs so much. I'll be criticized. I may not get the promotion. I may be in trouble with my boss." And we find one thing after the other that persuades us that we better not engage in that particular struggle. And yet I think Frodo has some truth to what he says, or we have to assume that in the struggle against evil, if we join in it, we're not going to come through unscathed. It will have its effect for us too. Number 9, I suspect, is going to tie in with something that we mentioned just a little while ago. We will touch it again. Evil is not defeat. Nine. Evil is not all powerful. It has its limitations. Sauron, and this is one of the evil wizards, Sauron's primary weakness is a lack of imagination. For while good can imagine what it would be like to be evil, evil cannot imagine what it would be like to be good. The evil are instinctively disloyal, brave only in numbers. Their wills are enslaved. The wicked betray each other. Find anything convincing about that? You've been at some time or other, perhaps in a struggle against something in your community or somewhere that you identified as evil. And before the showdown even really came, the forces on the other side were fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. And consequently, the struggle turned out to almost resolve itself. I think the explanation is here, at least it seems to me. Anyone have something to respond to on that one? You have no problems with it? Okay, let's
We've got a problem with it. If you're looking at institutional evil, then I think, yes, brave only in numbers makes sense. But this doesn't address the capacity for individual evil.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Or to address the issue that some people that we may consider evil think they're good. People right. We think that we're, you know, that hat can pass back and forth. And sometimes the absolutes are not there until you have a chance to distance yourself and re-examine it.
And of course, sometimes the truth is that in the struggle there is some good and some evil on both sides.
That's right.
And so it becomes harder to keep the issues clear. At, on the institutional level, I suspect there is some truth here that evil has difficulty imagining what it would be like to be good and acts according to its own nature. Number 10, evil is based on good corrupted or on privation of being. Saruman the Grey, who is a dubious character, was once Saruman the White. And about the orcs, it is said, the shadow that bred them can only mock, it cannot make. It did not give them life, it ruined and twisted them. Comes back again to that idea of evil is based on good corrupted. Anything you could think of that would illustrate that?
Yeah.
Judas.
Yes. Amendment.
Well, Augustine's definition of evil is the absence of good, which I don't think goes far enough because evil is too present. It's something that's more objectifiable. It seems to have presence in substance more than just absence.
All right. Thank you. And what were you going to say?
I just mentioned Judas.
Judas.
Started out with good intention.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyone else have an illustration of that or something to respond to with it? Yes?
Well, I think in our technology today where there are things that can be good, but they're often turned to evil.
Mm-hmm. Corrupted in their use, even if they are not evil in themselves. Okay. How about number 11? Evil blights nature as well as conscious beings. Sauron's lands are devastated and infertile. One of the signs of evil's presence is wanton destruction of nature. That's in Lord of the Rings now. Nature sometimes joins the fight against evil in Tolkien, letting us know the one is actively involved. Ropes, for instance, untie themselves. The centers of evil have plants and insects, but they are poisonous. Evil is more likely to be associated in Tolkien with technology than with natural forces. Saruman has a mind of metal and wheels. The Dark Tower is mechanically fortified. That must be troubling sometimes for people who are in the field of technology, to hit this kind of constant barrage. For instance, it's gotten to be in sometimes about the fact that technology is necessarily more associated with evil than with good. Am I misinterpreting me? Yes, sir?
A technology is valueless. It is a tool. And so how it is turned depends on who is turning it. Whereas, say, And so a computer can be turned to good. It can be very easily turned to evil. And how it's being used is a hell of a lot harder to figure out if it's being misused than if it's being used well. Because it's easy to hide it within an otherwise benevolent shell.
We rather commonly talk about the computer made a mistake. Most of the time, the computer didn't make a mistake. It was a human being running it that made it, yes.
And the great humor, we all sit here today because of technology. We weren't running out having to hand plow our fields and gather pigs because it's all the automation and it's the technology that's taken us that work away from us, a lot of us time to be up here. So, we laugh at that technology. So I'm a person interested in technology. I would often get great humor out of anti-technologists because their life exists mainly because of that technology.
I wondered sometimes, I don't know Oxford or Cambridge that well, though I spent a summer at Oxford that was very enlightening in many ways. I think Cambridge is far less ready to see evil in technology than Oxford, which is the more old traditional respect for a certain kind of learning. And maybe that affects Tolkien's view here too, but it's a common kind of view. In talking about many modern developments, of course, to look at them in terms of good and evil, and often to do it simplistically, as we've suggested here. Number 12, victory is never automatic. It must be earned or won over and over by each participant. Decisions about being involved are individual. When Frodo decides to accept the quest, Gandalf says, "I do not lay it on you, but if you take it freely, I will say you are right." And Bilbo and Frodo, the ring bearers, are said to be chosen, but they each have the right to refuse. This matter of the victory over evil having to be earned and won over and over, sometimes, however, we're getting that across to children. I have a feeling sometimes that the children, many of them, are being brought up in a society that teaches them to expect that life has to be lived at a continual high, a continual high of excitement. And if anything isn't providing that at the time, then goodness sakes, let's do something and get it going. And I wonder if instead maybe a part of what we need to be teaching is that there is a darker side to existence in which there is a continual struggle going on, not a continual attempt to live on a high. And if you feel like relating that to the drug traffic, I feel as if it can be. Anything?
Bring them to hold them.
Friend?
Bring them to hold them. The children.
There, now. Yeah, this is my first time at Holden, and I just find it so delightful to watch the children here. Because the expressions on their faces, the delight when they can have a little more time to be with Daddy, or a little more relaxed time with Mother, it's beautiful to see. I think your suggestion's wonderful. Okay, the 13, the outcome of the struggle against evil is as much in the hands of the small and the ordinary, the hobbits, as in the powerful, the wizards. And then the more I thought about that, the more I almost had to say, well, not quite. Because it helps to be a wizard and be able to have blue lightning come out of your fingertips. But I think basically the idea there is something that we need to know, because most of us are ordinary. And the part that we play, those millions of us that are ordinary, may have something as much to do with the outcome as the power in the hands of the powerful. I'd like to believe that at any rate. 14, the unknown but ultimate outcome is in the hands of the one. And the scholar Coker says, virtually without exception, the elves, men, hobbits, and their allies come to believe in a moral dynamism in the universe to which each of them freely contributes without knowing exactly how and without being at all sure how it will eventually work out in the war against Sauron. Beyond the moral dynamism is the rule of one who keeps his control in firm hands. When in the crisis, it looks as if all will be lost and good defeated, comes the cry, the eagles are coming, and the tide is reversed. Some of you, I'm sure, know the devotional writings of E. Stanley Jones, who is often called the apostle to the intellectuals, founder of the ashram movement. And I'm always pleased, and it isn't because philosophically I understand it all, but when he comes forth again and again with this insistence that this is a universe which recognizes morality and which reinforces it. If you insist on hating, it will have an effect on you physically. It will have an effect on you physically, but it may also affect the whole surrounding the environment around you. There is a sense in which moral issues in the universe will have their say, and certainly Tolkien believes that. 15, morality is rewarded in the idea of resurrection and afterlife. There is a suggestion of this in Tolkien, though he never goes into it very much. 16, there is eucatastrophe or the Evangelium. There is the presence of hope, the confidence in the worthwhileness of moral struggle, of each doing his part, even if it be only the part a heart can play, one of the little people. The quest may be attempted as much by the weak with as much hope as the strong, yet such is the course of deeds that move the wheels of the world. Small hands do them because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere. Well, we've said only a few of the many things that could be said about good and evil, and many of them I'm sure I've said in ways that are easy to challenge and that could have been said better. But I hope it's stimulated some thought of good and evil and its reality, and the necessary fact that we must be engaged in it one way or the other. Thank you for coming.